Hello and welcome to episode 70 of Entertainment of Excellence, the podcast where we talk about films, TV, all of it. Hi, I'm Ollie.
I'm Tom.
And I'm Ben.
And today we're talking about the 2005 film Electroma.
The first half of this will be completely spoiler-free, and then we'll be doing a deep dive from around the 20-minute mark. So the second half will contain spoilers.
Timestamps below. So, the movie Electroma.
Or Daft Punk's Electroma.
Or, yeah, depending on who you ask.
Pardon me.
If you are looking it up on Letterboxd, it's just Electroma, as I found
Ooh.
Out. Yeah. So, this is a movie. I'll try and describe what happens with no spoilers. Where two robots who have Daft Punk leather jackets on, so I assume Daft Punk, seem to want to become human because they go on a long journey in a car. They go to a town where everyone else has the robot heads and things, and then they try and get human faces and become human, and things go awry, as you might say. But a lot of the plot, I want to emphasize, there is zero dialogue, so it's very much a visual storytelling medium, because that's the only way you can garner information. So there isn't a concrete...
It's quite an artsy film.
Yeah.
A lot of the focus is sort of on the characters doing stuff without saying anything, lots of long shots, some music to sort of enhance certain scenes, and... Yeah, plot-wise, not an awful lot happens, but I think, I mean, I'd be interested to hear what you guys think about the pacing of it.
The pacing is interesting because I think that there were some really, I would call it, I guess, like standout set pieces almost.
Yeah.
Like there's certain sequences that I was like, whoa, I wouldn't necessarily go, oh, awesome, but...
You very nearly did while we were watching it.
Well, I know, I basically was, but when I go, oh, awesome, what I really mean is, wow, what an impactful and moving scene.
Yeah. Mm.
That's what I mean when I go, oh, sick, yeah. You might hear me doing that in things like the end of The Green Mile or the end of Dead Poets Society. No, I'm just... Never mind.
Oh, that's pretty awesome.
Go, yeah, awesome!
Yeah, I don't think the pacing suffered too much, to be honest. Like, I think as long as the shots are interesting enough, it holds my attention, and it's not like this was a very long film to start off with, and I just think it was like consistently interesting cinematography-wise that I never really found my attention slipping.
I think the only places it tests it is that there's a few like traveling sequences which kind of feel like interim because they need to be shown traveling towards things, but it is supposed to be a kind of pilgrimage that they're on, I think.
Yeah.
So the only thing is like the start is quite slow. I think that's the only time where I was like, because also I didn't know what this was at all. So at the start I was like, they've been in this car a while.
Yeah, but yeah. I often find that if that's an introduction to a film and it's slow like that, it's not quite as bad as if it would be later, because first of all you're just a bit more naturally fatigued, and also you are trying to get to grips with what it's going for, so you're looking out for more stuff. But I see what you mean, like in terms of a introduction, it's a bit more stripped back than like the thing that comes next, where it's a bit more eventful, and then it kind of goes back to... Well, obviously, we'll talk about the ending more when it gets to the spoiler part, but the ending's a little bit more slow-paced again.
Yeah, I agree that it's best place where it is as a sequence. And it's fine. It sets the tone well. It's just that if you don't know what's going on, that's like the only bit that I felt like it could have suffered a bit, because also there is a similarly slow-paced kind of travel sequence further on towards the end, but I think that that one uses shots more interestingly and gets a bit more surreal and does some things that we'll talk about later.
See, I found that sort of interim one, that was the one that I felt you could have cut a little bit out of. I was fine with the intro, but then to be fair, I have seen this film before. Not for years, probably, I think 7-8 years at this point. But I kind of did know what I was doing going in. So it was probably that first introduction sequence wasn't as jarring. But if you're not into sort of artsy films with lots of cinematography, it's probably not going to be one for you.
If you're the person that will say artsy fartsy, then that's fine, because I also love watching. I mean, I love Blues Brothers, is one of my favourites, and that is literally just ends with hundreds and hundreds of cars crashing into each other. You know, I'm a big fan of wacky spectacle, but if you're like, art house isn't for me, then I probably don't watch this.
No.
Yeah. So should we touch a little bit on the sort of themes of the film? Because it's quite an interesting one in that. So the directors, the Daft Punk members, Thomas Bangalter and Kim-Manuel de Homem-Christo, I think. They said about the film that they weren't going for anything sort of specific. It was more they were trying to pose a question without an answer, so the viewer can kind of interpret it how they want. How did you guys interpret it?
Oh, well, let's dive into this now. One of our favourite movies, I think collectively, is 2001, A Space Odyssey, which has a very similar thesis. I believe the books answer more questions, but the movie is very open-ended. But I was a big fan. And one of the things that I want to specifically talk about is the sequence through the town where everyone else has the robot heads. That was interesting because it's obviously these two are on this quest to become human. And it felt like having everyone else have these same robot heads, it's like one of those things where I couldn't tell if it was the step before or the step after that knowledge that, you know, the knowledge that like everyone else in the world leads their own individual life.
Yeah.
I couldn't tell if that's either they're at the stage before that where they kind of don't see them as individualistic, which I don't think is the interpretation. I feel like it's the step after because of what they're trying to do, which is that everyone else is living their own individual lives, but also you feel the kind of insignificance of human life that everyone's kind of trapped to doing these set things because of, I don't know, societal norms or whatever.
Yeah.
So it feels it's very like existential and depressing, I think, like.
Yeah. Another slight the different interpretation, which I'm not sure you might have picked up on or not, but I feel like it's quite interesting in terms of looking at Daft Punk themselves as the creators behind this and like their legacy in the music industry and how they kind of came on the scene as this, I mean, really revolutionary group, and how this is, what, was the first album 97?
Yeah, I think so. Homework.
So this is sort of like 8 years into their career, where you have a lot of sort of copycats starting to emerge and stuff. And I think it's quite interesting, like just that visual image of all these clones of them and then them trying to like form some sort of individuality and identity outside of that. And then ultimately what happens towards the end of the film, I don't know if there's some sort of like meta thing there in terms of their own view of how of the music industry and their impact upon it.
See, interestingly, my interpretation was different to both of you. I've
film open to interpretation gets three different interpretations.
Who would have guessed? See, I kind of read it more as a sort of not being able to fit into the sort of social norms. So without spoiling it, the two robots who are the protagonists on a quest to become human, and they do something that makes them look human. And there's a sequence where everyone else is still just in a robot costume, And by them doing this sort of like almost caricature of humanity, they instantly stand out, and there's some hostility towards that. And I read that as sort of like you could maybe like go deeper and have it as an allegory for like specific things, but like I think not fitting into like societal roles was kind of how I interpreted it. And it's a bit of a depressing movie because there's no real sort of like positive message with that. It's kind of like, oh, we don't fit into these societal roles. Oh, well, that's very depressing.
Yeah.
And yeah, so that's my interpretation.
Yeah, I mean, as people say, the only positive spin is that the two robots, Hero Robot 1 and Hero Robot 2, as they are named, I think we might call them Gold and Silver, just
to differentiate them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that they are kind of within this together. But interestingly, throughout the film, they are in it together and go through very similar struggles. But we were talking about they somehow have quite different characterizations despite being two faceless robots.
Mm.
It's really interesting because a film with no dialogue and no facial expressions, with both of these robot helmets covering up like any form of expression, it means that the individuality kind of comes from the mannerisms and the sort of reactions to things.
Mm.
And it's really fascinating to see, as you said, both of these characters, Gold and Silver, have very, very different characters, and you can feel sort of the emotions that are tugging away at them during different sequences just by their reactions to things. And again, their characters are very different to the rest of the robots in the town, who all seem very sort of monolithic. They're all just kind of the same. They don't really have any personality. It felt to me like they were kind of going through the motions. It's like, you know, just watering the plants and reading a newspaper, and
it was very stereotypical American suburbia.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like someone getting married and everyone's just sort of slowly clapping. But it
was
felt kind of empty.
But then I think what's quite interesting about that is like the homogeneity of all the other people in the, it's almost like you're presented of to that through the lens of the two protagonists who, as you say, are identifiable and distinct despite being the same as these other people, essentially, like in look. So you start to think like, well, is that sort of their way of showing that? And that's why they have to make this conscious effort to try and break away from this conformity. It's like, well, if this film was, say, framed from one of these other people living in this town, then perhaps, you know, just by the way that they became the protagonist, almost just the way the narrative was structured, it would inherently make their life more interesting. It's just like being presented it as an outsider type thing. It was made to look very ordinary and that, but you know, is that just like a very surface level thing? And it's almost like reveals more about our protagonists
and their view of these people than their inherent sort of characteristics. Yeah. It's an interesting one. It'd be one where I'd be very interested to hear like other people's interpretations as well, because it's like I feel like the fact that the film, it has a sort of emotional journey and you can kind of take away a sort of message from it, but it's a very sort of blank canvas in that, like, I think it reflects more on the viewer watching it and their own experience with how they sort of take meaning from it.
Mm. So leave them in the comments below.
So yeah, leave them in the comments. And
because as you said,
harass us on Instagram.
When you were reading that some people have sort of a positive interpretation of this, to me, it's not, doesn't come across as that whatsoever. Because
it doesn't to me at all.
I think the only real glimpses of hope or optimism you could get out of this is the connection between the two of them. But
yeah,
as you said when we were watching it, it's very bittersweet. I mean,
I
won't say any more without going to the ending. But
yeah, you get a real sense of like really deep friendship between the two protagonists. And there's a scene sort of about halfway through where this really comes across, and they're both reacting to something that's just happened. One of them kind of takes it, like the gold one kind of takes it fairly well.
I don't know. I think they seem kind of angry. I thought that theirs was really a kind of moment of anger and they were fed up, whereas the silver one, it just kind of stands there and either takes it in a very despairing way or is in denial.
I felt like Gold was
bathroom.
Sort of initially angry and fed up, but then kind of it reached acceptance first.
Well, isn't it Gold that's like taking the thing off?
Yeah.
I'd say that's definitely more that he has come to be accepting of it.
And then Silver's
still clinging on.
Kind of, really just clinging on to the hope of this scene.
Well, I'm going to change topic to the music so we can come back to that spoilers.
We'll talk about the music and the cinematography.
Yeah.
Because they're the biggest aspects of this film.
So the soundtrack, initially at the start, Ben said, from memory, this doesn't have any Daft Punk music in. And I thought he was joking.
No, it doesn't have a single Daft Punk song.
But it doesn't have actually any. And I even like... there's like a Brian Eno song, which I thought could be Daft Punk because it sounds like it could just be soundtrack, but no, it's not them. But it uses these song choices really well to heighten the emotion of the scenes and this kind of bond between them that have good ones. And then also the soundtrack in general, that if it doesn't play music, it has very low, ominous, rumbling sounds. It's like the whole movie, I thought, just had a sense of impending doom.
The other thing, interesting thing, is the film was kind of born out of this this project where they were trying to film a music video for one of their songs off the Human After All album, and it kind of got bigger and bigger until it was going to be like for the whole album, and then they just decided not to do any music in it. And I think that was the right choice, because that album, Human After All, is really sort of, it's really aggressive.
Yeah, it's very abrasive compared to their other stuff.
Like screaming guitars and synths and like really hard drum machines. It's a really kind of, it wouldn't have fit well on this, I don't think, which is a lot more sort of spacey and pretty with like the imagery that, because it's all set in either in the desert or in a sort of town that's kind of close to a desert, and you get this real sense of like huge empty space.
I think it is quite impressive on their part to make a film like this and not include any of the music. I kind of respect them more for doing that, because especially following their previous album Discovery, how they made Interstellar 5555 to go alongside that, and that's very much sort of the opposite in this. That is, again, there's no dialogue or anything, but it's very much narrative driven, very sort of futuristic, and goes alongside the album. Like it's like the whole album goes throughout.
Yeah,
it's an
album length sort of music video.
So to then do something like this, which completely pivots and is still distinctly them without using any of their own songs and stuff, but still the music is still a very integral part to it, and it's kind of like I guess it has sort of dystopian elements in the sense of all this vast desert and like all the sort of clones, but it doesn't feel very it's not like futuristic in the same sense that the previous film was. So I think it shows like a very wide range of sort of skill on their part to do something so distinctly different, but still like equally as profound, I'd say.
Yeah, and I feel another thing to mention is the sound design. If you have access to it, I'd say definitely watch this with either a good hi-fi system with a subwoofer or even just headphones, because there's a lot of sequences in the first half that rely on sort of low, really low-pitched rumbling sounds. But then they switch up sometimes and you get higher-pitched ones and lower-pitched ones, which really kind of give you this sense of like being unsettled and not knowing what's going on. And I think if you're just watching it like without something that can reproduce those frequencies, you'd miss like that sequence might be a bit more boring.
Yeah.
So yeah, headphones if a subwoofer or something, because there's some points where that's the only sound.
Yeah, exactly. Because even though we are talking about the music quite a bit, it's not actually, it's used relatively sparingly.
Yeah.
But the sound design itself is really that adds to the atmosphere, especially in the scene, like the all white room and the.
Yeah, which the cinematography is also great. Like that was one of the standout scenes, is this bit where, as they're going in, I think the room is white, and then you see the people like outside are just black silhouettes, right? They look, and then you kind of see it from the other side where now the room's white, so outside's black, and the guards people are like completely white, and then everyone within this room is like completely white, and it's this strange like retro futuristic.
You can't see anyone. Lab. Everyone's sort of an outline.
Yeah, which was like so cool. And it's like the cinematography throughout was really good, but actually it did actually show a range. Like, so it starts off with these vast landscape shots and sweeping through with moving them in the car. Then it shows that they can do this kind of weird conceptual sci-fi stuff. They can also do the slow like tracking shots around the town.
And there's like shaky cams.
Yeah, like shaky cam, the claustrophobic feel of that bathroom scene. Like it really shows quite a lot of range, which I was surprised.
This was all the cinematography was done by Tomas from Daft Punk, and this is his first film. They directed like music videos before, but I read that he'd read like something like 200 issues of American cinematographer to prepare for it.
I mean, it shows, because as you say, the film starts and then there's some desert sequences later, and you think, oh, is it all just going to be this type of cinematography? Which, you know, it's still very impressive and whatever, but it is really down to that range. Like, I think the scene where they are going through the town with the faces on, like, it's so, it feels very close up and like frantic and stuff, and you see these people looking at them and it all like very tense.
Yeah.
And I think that's really enhanced by the way it was shot.
And there's lots of great framing of things. Like there's a bit towards the end where one of them's walking away from the other one, which is like, whoa, awesome.
Yeah. There's the physical release of it, or at least the physical one I have, is a DVD that comes in like a 40-page book.
Sorry, Ben, I thought you were on about a physical release from your body. I was like, what is Ben about to say?
Just because you physically released something the other episode.
Oh god. Anyway, go on.
No, but like the fact that there's a 40-page book that like has like 40 sort of iconic shots from the film, and they all kind of still hold their weight as a still image, just really goes to show like how well they're framed and how well they've been shot.
Every frame a painting.
Yeah.
Yeah, EFAP.
All right, then. We thought we weren't talking about that kind of physical release. Shall we move into...
This is a Christian-friendly podcast.
Should we move into spoilers?
Yeah, we should. Yeah,
yeah. So if you haven't seen the film already, from now on we'll be talking about it and we will have spoilers. So if you don't care about it and you actually do want to watch us, keep watching. If not, come back after you've watched it.
Thanks, Gawthorne.
Yeah. All right, Gawthorne. So yeah, the spoilers.
Welcome to the spoiler zone.
Ooh.
This is where the cool people hang out.
So how about you give the synopsis with the spoilers now?
So when they go to the town to become human, they get weird goop faces that turn them into humans, but the faces melt in the sun in a very quite distressing way. And then they get chased by a mob that drives them out of the town. So then they end up trekking through the desert. And it seems that Silver kind of... Or they both kind of give up, so Gold like sets Silver to self-destruct, and then he just blows up, and then Gold cannot reach the self-destruct compartment on his back, so has to just set himself on fire by smashing in his helmet and then using it like a magnifying glass to set himself on fire.
Yeah, it's a really kind of depressing ending, but yeah. So if you've seen the video Daft Punk epilogue which they released when they broke up, unfortunately that's kind of the emotional climax of the film. So but it's still worth watching the rest of it, because I feel like that scene in particular holds more weight once you've kind of seen had the reactions of everyone in the town.
Yeah, definitely. Because I mean, I'd seen that the breakup video when it was released, not really knowing of this film, to be honest. And I thought maybe then learning that it come from that, it might diminish the emotional impact of it. But I don't think it did, because it really does help having it within the context of everything that's come before. And as you say, I think it makes sense that Silver's the one that is blown up in terms of what was established before. And, you know, this identity that's able to be established despite them not ever speaking or anything.
Because there's this turning point in the bathroom scene, which we hinted at in the spoiler-free section, where Silver, once his face is melted, he's still clinging on to this sort of last hope of...
He's just kind of...
trying to push it back up his face.
Oh, awful. And then the eyes pop and stuff.
Yeah. Whereas...
He's staring like into the mirror, and it's just like... It's like, imagine crying, but it's your face falling off as tears.
Yeah. Gold's like really sort of distressed by it, but then there's this scene where he flushes it down the toilet,
face in the toilet, and then he goes like...
And after that point, he's just kind of wiping himself down.
One thing I want to mention about that scene is that I've not listened to Human After All, so I didn't know it was more frantic music. Because towards the start, I was kind of like, maybe I would have preferred this with Daft Punk's soundtrack. But that scene in particular, I actually really liked that they chose this song called Universe by Sebastian Tellier, which is kind of just so somber and melancholy, and it's like within these frantic and tragic scenes. Whereas if you took what I would say would be the more obvious choice of also frantic music, it wouldn't have had the same impact. And that scene for me is the peak. Like, I know that technically the emotional climax is when they both blow up, one of them blows up, the other one sets on fire. But for me, that was like the peak.
Yeah. Especially it kept flashing dark and then back on and off. It's so really cool, and
it was just really, really cool to see how they got this really deeply impactful scene in without any real facial expressions. It's just kind of the horror of the faces melting off, and like Silver just kind of staring in the mirror, peeling off him, and you can see his robot face underneath it again.
Yeah, and it was also that bit that made me realise that it was such a cool choice that for their like humanification, they just kind of put the faces on top
of the helmets,
faces. Because obviously, you know that it's two people in a suit. If they took the helmets off, it's just two guys. So the fact that like to become humans, they put it over the top is like obviously a very specific choice, and I'm like, whoa, that's cool, because it's, you know, it means that it shows that it's more like a mask.
Exactly. And I feel like that's almost sort of reflective of Daft Punk and other people in the music industry who kind of get famous wearing a mask or some sort of costume of some description, and then it's almost
Marshmallow.
It's almost like, is that the only, does that become like part of the appeal? And then almost if they did, like, there'd be this initial hype about, oh, who's behind the mask or whatever. And Daft Punk were never really like, people knew who they were, right, and what they looked
like.
But it'd almost be like that would lose some of its charm. So it's almost like them questioning that, whether that's, you know, so ingrained within their appeal in terms of
effect.
Yeah, exactly.
There's always been pictures of them out, but I think there was kind of a public move of like, you don't look at it because their whole persona is in these masks.
I've never looked them up. I've just been like, well, it's the two guys with the masks.
Yeah.
I'll just know that it's probably just two guys.
But the other interesting thing is, knowing what they look like, I think the faces they were doing were kind of caricatures of their real life faces, which is an interesting choice. And then I suppose kind of going on down this same path, when once Silver's blown up and Gold's alone in the desert, he takes his helmet off and you just see underneath it and it's just this like
circuit board
like really like cut vertically.
It's so spooky.
Yeah, it's quite eerie. And throughout the entire film there's these shots of like something on fire and you can kind of see something in the background. And then the instant you're like, oh, it's him on fire in the future.
The circuit board they put like, so they do put two kind of silver ringed holes, which are clearly supposed to be the eyes, but put them in, you know, off angle in slightly non-eye positions, which help to make it feel more robotic and alien, but you can tell.
It's an eye.
And there's this bit where like they smash their helmet in this moment of like anger, and then they just kind of stare towards the floor, and it was like, I could feel that they were crying, and it's literally, you're literally looking at a circuit board, which is pretty cool. And also when they're setting themselves on fire, they made a really great choice, I thought, where they could have just kind of held their hand there as it sets on fire, but the whole time they're moving the fingers, and that like really
you
made it more
some
visceral.
Of the flesh come off,
Well, even though it's just like plastic or whatever, but it's because they're moving the fingers still, it feels a lot more visceral. And I was like, ooh,
yeah,
which is an interesting choice because, earlier in the film, whilst they were getting the prosthetics put on, they were,
you were
commenting on like how deathly still they were, no feet moving or anything.
Yeah, it was pretty spooky. I was a bit spooked.
It was pretty spooky.
We need to talk about the scene that Ben didn't pick up when he was 14.
This is what I was
So the films are 15. We should have probably mentioned if you're under 15, don't watch it. But you know, that'd be a bit rich coming from me watching it as a 13-year-old. Yeah, so there's this scene after the bathroom scene when they're just walking through the desert. There's a lot of shots of sand dunes and stuff. And, you know, I think all three of us were thinking these kind of look a bit like, you know, like curves on a woman's body.
I know, but I was like, oh, I'm just being
kind of looks like a boob.
Crude and immature.
It's just in their head. And then there's a shot of someone's vulva. So
literally like, you're facing up, like your head's between their thighs.
Yeah, it's like you're
somehow
going,
still kind of looks like it's but deserty. It's cleverly done.
I don't know how they did that.
Like the pubes look like grass.
But it was like 100% genitalia.
Yeah.
But like the rest of the body looked quite sand.
Oh my God.
Do you think they just covered someone in sand?
Well, so I was looking through the credits and it was like Hero Robot 1, Hero Robot 2, you know, and all of the other robots. And then there was just Woman.
Woman, yeah.
I was like, oh, where's the woman? Oh yeah, that scene.
Yeah, that'll be her.
You tell me it wasn't grass and sand.
So yeah, that which is interesting. That is quite shocking, but
it is a bit shocking. But you can kind of like you can kind of prize some meaning out of it in the context of the plot, I guess.
I mean, I guess it could be rebirth, but like thinking on what happened to them now, where they just kind of blow up and then set themselves on fire. Because basically the shot is zooming in, shall we say.
Yeah.
Maybe. Which is could be a kind of return to the grave.
What you were before.
Yeah. Rather than just...
coming out of the vulva.
Yeah. Rather than just, oh, genitals.
Yeah.
I mean, stuff like that, you can see why people who weren't really into this would say it was a bit pretentious and artsy.
Yeah.
But, I mean... to me, like none of it really overstayed its welcome, and I feel like it was consistently interesting cinematography-wise, where it like literally pulled me in.
Yeah,
but also to be, I think it's kind of punk, if you will, Daft Punk.
That's
a reference to the name of the band.
To be a very commercially successful. I wouldn't say they were a properly pop group at that point, but they did. They had lots of big dance tunes.
Very popular.
Like a very popular music group. And then to just, in your movie, decide to go, yeah, we're going to put like melting faces and like nude bodies in this.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. Like if Taylor Swift did that, there'd be an uproar.
Yeah. Well, it's like, The music videos have always been really interesting because, like, they had like Spike Jonze do it, like a couple of the music videos in like the 90s.
Spike Jonze did loads of stuff. He directed like Weezer music videos back in the day.
Yeah, and
Weezer
like
and Daft Punk collab would go hard.
He did the Sweater song music video because they specifically said in the pitch, we don't want the music video to have anything to do with a sweater in it.
Right.
And his was the only pitch that didn't have a sweater in.
Yeah.
There you go.
So, but yeah, and it's a very weird move for like someone who is pretty much at the peak of their career, to like just go all in on a weird art house movie.
Well, that's the thing. I feel like they've never really sold out though, because I mean, even if you look at Random Access Memories, which is by far their poppiest album and most commercially successful, they then didn't really release any music for almost 10 years.
They didn't tour it
or
anything.
Breaking up, like they've never really just done it to be successful almost, or like for money or whatever. They just not even had the most prolific output whilst they're around, but always doing interesting and challenging things. And I feel like this is, I mean, it's quite underground. I don't hear a lot of people discussing it outside the sort of Daft Punk fandom. So the fact that they were still able to do stuff that's genuinely artful outside of music, and it doesn't really like, I mean, it's still watched by quite a few people, but it's not like, oh well, just because it's Daft Punk, people are going to love it. You know, it is. Didn't you say like initially when it was first released, it was quite controversial?
Yeah, I think it had a release, a limited release at like the Cannes Film Festival, and stuff like that, and people just weren't really into it. Like a lot of people walked out and stuff like that, and it's just like it makes sense because it's such a sort of like specific approach to filmmaking that like it makes sense that it's not for everyone.
Yeah, but if you're at Cannes, then you'd have
thought if you were there, like,
probably the least pretentious thing at that point.
Yeah, but yeah, that's the thing. Like, I felt very much rewatching it. I was a little bit worried it would drag, and the only thing I thought dragged a little bit was the bit before the vulva.
There was quite a lot of desert shot, wasn't there?
You were just waiting for it.
You were waiting for it. You were on the edge of your seat, Ben.
Yeah, I was waiting for it.
But of course, you just thought it was grass and sand.
You just the grass and sand. I didn't know why I was excited for some grass and sand, but you know, the feeling was that. No, but the like 110, not 110 minutes, 1 hour and 10 minutes, that's like pretty reasonable for a film this length. It didn't overstay its welcome, really.
No,
it was, yeah.
So, speaking of not overstaying welcomes, can we rate the movie?
Oh, yeah.
What would you rate it?
Oh, do I have to go first?
Well, I don't know why, but you always do seem to go first.
This is just because I feel like I have to take the initiative from you two slowpokes. You can't decide on their bloody rating.
Well, that's because we have to do it to more than one decimal place.
Even I'm struggling. I think today what we're going to go with is there's some very impactful shots and sequences. I loved all the music. It was great, but I did feel a bit slow for me in points, and it didn't. I feel it didn't fully impact me as much as it could have done, but I still like really enjoyed it. It's partially some of the problem was that we were just saying things that rhymed with Daft Punk at one point. to help pass the desert scene, I think, like Waft Junk or Shaft Monk. But I think I'll give it a 7.
That's pretty solid. I really enjoyed it as well. I feel like it, like the fact that it's able to enable a discussion and have different interpretations with no dialogue is like,
it's always a good sign, isn't it?
Effective. I mean, I feel like I'm a bit biased because I've sort of liked Daft Punk since I can remember.
Oh, yeah. I'm the non-Daft Punk fan view, by the way, because
Ben's the biggest one. But
yeah, Punk was like the gateway drug into music, full stop, for me. Yeah.
And I think it was kind of me that got you into it.
Yeah,
right?
So you were the OG.
I'm the OG, but you're the biggest.
I've probably listened, to give an example, I think I've listened to Random Access Memories twice nice. And Homework once is my Daft Punk knowledge.
You've listened to Discovery.
You've not listened to Discovery.
Or I might have listened to also Discovery once.
Discovery is a classic.
But I listened to DiGiorgio quite a lot. DiGiorgio by Moroder, sorry.
Oh, yeah.
Listen to Human After All once.
Okay.
I don't replay it a lot, but it's interesting to listen to once.
Cool.
Maybe it's also not very long compared to the first album. I'd go 7.9.
Oh.
I don't know why it's not an 8, but
7.9.
Actually, yeah, I'll do an 8. Around solid 8.0.
God, that means it goes from underrated gem to absolute classic at that 0.1.
Yeah, because the EOV range, it's like, if it's in a 7.8, it's terrible. If it's a 7.9, it's all right. If it's an 8, it's a bloody classic.
That's the scale.
And then if it's higher than an 8, it's 2001.
That's the one film.
Yeah.
Not quite, but close to that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like I'm more towards Ollie in that I really enjoyed it on a rewatch, and of course there's some feelings of nostalgia in it for me, given I watched it when I was much younger. But I think I also picked up on a lot of stuff this time that I didn't the first time round, a lot of the themes and a lot of the vulva and. But yeah, I think it resonated with me a lot more now than it did when I was younger. So I'm going to go. Ooh.
Get ready, everyone.
8.3.
Oh my God.
See, the issue with that is I feel like it's almost a bit arbitrary at this point because I don't have anything in front of me to reference, but also I'm constantly saying how I'd change my old ratings. So, you know what? It's all arbitrary. It doesn't matter.
Go with your gut feeling, Ben.
My gut feeling says 8.3.
Well done, everyone.
So this is kind of related, but what age did you first watch A Clockwork Orange? I remember you saying that was
Around 13. Oh, my God.
Well, did you understand what was going on in that?
Oh, I understood what was going on in that.
Really?
The scene where he snips off the dress. yeah.
Nice.
But he's just a lovely little man who goes around drinking milk.
Well, surprisingly,
he's misunderstood.
In our submission spotlight, Stanley Kubrick has submitted A Clockwork Orange.
Wow.
No. Stanley, calm down, buddy.
Just joking. Stanley Kubrick's
dead.
So we don't have a submission this week. He would have sent us it, but.
We were kind of also hoping there's this guy who I think, listen to the podcast a bit. He's called Tarkovsky, but he died of radiation poisoning. So
he would have submitted Solaris, though. It's a big shame.
Yeah.
Yeah. He said, our episodes got him through editing Stalker.
Which is why we did process, that episode on Stalker.
Well, just like Kangaroo Jack on repeat.
Tarkovsky loved the Kangaroo Jack episode.
Did. He got up to 1,000. Views.
It couldn't happen here is also on 1,000 views. In
YouTube. Yeah, that was partially Tarkovsky as well, actually. Yeah. He's a big Pet Shop Boys fan.
If you listen very closely in Stalker, you can actually hear it's a sin.
If your name's Tarkovsky or Kubrick, then send in your submissions. If you're not called Tarkovsky or Kubrick, then also send in your submissions, because you might be the next Kubrick.
Where can they send them in, Ben?
They can send them in via the contact form and entertainmentofexcellence.weebly.com, or our email entertainmentofexcellence@gmail.com, or you can DM us on Instagram or TikTok at EOV Podcast, which we'll be posting our recommendations on.
Ooh.
Extra content.
Ooh. I love content.
So do I, which is why you should go and follow us on those platforms as well.
Wow.
And so and make sure if you're on YouTube to hit that subscribe button and slam that notification bell.
Yes.
Because otherwise apparently people don't check the subscription feeds. Am I the only one that does that?
I check them as well. Yeah. I think that people are lying to get people to hit the notification bell. But hit the notification bell.
Notification bell.
And also leave a like. Anyway, is it
time
for recommendations?
Jingle.
That we may have heard the jingle. We still don't know. Well, I've got a recommendation.
Ooh.
Really?
So do I.
Ollie graciously gifted me recently some DVDs, and I've watched one of them, which was City of God, which is a 2002, I think, around then, Brazilian crime movie, and it's just great. It's got, like, what really drew me in was, like, the rhythm of it. Like, it's kind of shot in this not frenetic way, but it's like they're not necessarily moving shots, but the shots just feel dynamic. The cuts are like quick, but in a good way, not a Bohemian Rhapsody way. It has all of these, like, the structure's really cool, where it does an in media ray opening, which is, you gotta love, but then it is effectively in chronological order, apart from certain bits where it will introduce a character and then show their backstory. And it's like each bit, it's split into very, very short chapter sections, not like movies that have like three big chapters. It's like, it's almost like a collection of short stories that together tells this larger narrative, but the whole time it doesn't feel like you're watching short stories. I don't know how to explain it. It's really cool, which means that you get to see all of these smaller moments which are kind of emphasized as more important, and you get to like really like some of these characters, hate the others, and also feel this kind of neglect that the people in the slums of Rio feel, and also how you can understand why like a drug lord might rise to power and why people might accept that, because it can actually lead to some safety sometimes. It's really interesting. Great movie. You've got to be okay with seeing some children get shot. Sorry about that. I always feel like I have to bring that up because I'm like, oh, it's a great movie. It's like really fast paced and fun. Also, children get shot. Sorry about that. but it's good. And one of my favorite sequences is where there's a character that is going to do some crimes, but every time decides not to because he likes the people too much. And I just thought that was great. So yeah, that's my recommendation. City of God. Go watch it. It's good. Nice. There you go.
Do you want to go, Ben, or shall I?
Well, so I haven't been watching many movies recently, but recently I mean like the last sort of 2 years. But there was a movie that I watched recently quite enjoy. It was called Chicken Run 2.
Oh! Dawn of the Nugget.
Dawn of the Nugget.
Which I didn't understand the title until about half an hour in. I went,
oh! Yeah. It's a good, fun family movie with, you know, the bits of socialism and all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good way to indoctrinate your kids.
Yeah.
I slightly preferred the first one, so I guess it's a double recommendation. You should watch the first one too. But yeah, it's a pretty solid movie. As far as sequels go, it didn't suffer from a lot of the sort of, you know, trying to recapture the magic and kind of not really getting it.
I was like, oh, they've actually done a new movie.
Yeah. And it's like, because it's the same animation style as most like other Aardman stuff, it's like it takes weeks to animate like a scene. And I think anything that's done, any kind of animation that's done with like a physical medium like clay or plasticine or whatever, it kind of always enhances my enjoyment a bit, because I'm like, wow, this took like real humans lots of time to work on, and it looks this good.
It looks great, and it was interesting because it showed flashbacks for the first one.
Yeah,
and you can see how it actually does look different, despite being, it's a medium that I would assume always looks the same. But you're like, oh, but it's kind of got more color now, which makes sense because the first one is effectively supposed to be a prisoner of war camp because it's the Great Escape.
Yeah, and there are differences in the animation, but it's still it's like it would have been so much easier to just CGI it.
Mm. But they didn't.
But they didn't, which is good. So I'll be watching closely to see what the new Wallace and Gromit will be like, because yeah, I have mixed feelings about not having Peter Sallis as Wallace, because he's died, unfortunately. But you know, if it's the same team, the same writers,
Nick Park.
You know, it's Nick Park. You know, it'll be a walk in the park because it's
Nick Park.
So yeah, if they can get someone else to kind of embody Wallace as good as Peter Sallis did, I think it will be good.
It would.
So that is my recommendation.
Chicken one, run and two.
Yeah.
My recommendation is Godzilla Minus One.
Oh,
not Godzilla Minus Two.
Oh,
Dawn of the Nugget, which is a Japanese Godzilla film that seems to be gaining like quite a cult following online, yeah, and getting really good reviews. I mean, it takes sort of the you know, basic Godzilla plot, but kind of a slightly new approach where it's set just after World War II. And it's like really, really dealing with Japan's defeat and how they're already at zero, basically. And then Godzilla comes along and they drop below that.
To where?
To minus two.
Oh.
not even minus three.
No.
Is that when Kong comes along?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
But I think it just had way more of an emotional human core than the American ones I've seen, like the 2014 Godzilla film, which wasn't bad by any means, but I think this one really captures like the human side to it a lot better, because the protagonist is this sort of kamikaze pilot who basically got scared, didn't do it, pretended his there was some fault with his plane, and he's kind of shunned when he returns back home, and then he starts to build this connection with someone, and then, well, I won't give away what happens. I had a slight issue with the ending because it felt like everything sort of returned to normal a bit too conveniently, and they also teased another one. But I think it, not only the human side, but like the actual presentation of Godzilla himself was terrifying. Like every time he was on screen, he would like be bigger than previously, and like it actually captured the real fear of like his atomic blast and stuff. And
did you?
There was I did in the cinema. But there's no sort of redeeming qualities to it. Like no attempts to really. I feel like in the more recent ones they've tried to make him a bit more human-esque, but this was just like full-blown monster, and
he's just this phenomenon.
Yeah, and it was like actually quite an interesting way that they devised of trying to take him down, but it wasn't like the whole film was sort of spent in boardrooms saying, oh, what should we do about this? It actually they came up with something. It's like it didn't go perfectly according to plan, but they sort of worked around it, and I think they wrote that in quite seamlessly, rather than it just being like excessively focusing on that side of it. So yeah, I think I mean, not that I've seen a lot of it, but it's probably my favorite sort of Godzilla type story thing that I've seen.
Damn.
I'd recommend that. It's nice to see some international cinema sort of getting this respect. That's not so much an artsy film, it's like you know, essentially a blockbuster, but still only on like a 10 mil budget or something. And it really shows like what can be achieved on that type of budget when you're not having to pay for Hollywood style actors, basically. So yeah,
when was it released?
This year, well, 2023, I guess.
Nice.
So last year.
Yeah. Might still be in cinemas, Ben, for you. Ooh. Not for you.
No,
not for you.
You're too late.
Yeah, you'll be viewing this in 2026. So,
yeah.
Maybe Ben will watch another film by then.
Yeah, maybe Chicken Run 3 will be out.
Oh,
yeah.
Definitely will grow it.
Yeah.
Cool. So,
is it time to wrap up?
It is time to wrap up. But before we do that, it's time for the
catchphrase.
Catchphrase. Well, in the eternal words of Hero Robot 1 and Hero Robot 2 in Electroma.
That's good.
All right, see you. Follow us on socials. UV Podcast.
It took me a second to get.
presented by Ollie Luff, Tom Sweeney, and Ben Stinson. Music by Tom Sweeney and Ben Stinson. Audio engineered by Ben Stinson at Longwater Productions. All Rights CER, created by Al Wright, Sr. All Rights, brackets, CER, close brackets, reserved.